dynamics and spatial intelligence using a DSCFC correspondence. And this is a work done with my bright and hardworking student Anastasia Steliotis at Ohio State University. And this is the web reference, which is has this 1234 number, which is really hard to remember. Okay, so I understand that I'm talking to a mixed audience. There are some people which are well-versed in string theory, you know, way over my head. I'm definitely not an expert on ADS, and there are also people well-versed in Hebbian collisions, and not everybody is both. So I'll try to keep things simple on both sides. So sometimes I'll say things which are trivial for Hebbian experts, sometimes I'll say things which are trivial for string theory experts. Just bear with me, and you'll get through it. Okay, so instead of the outline, in a very nice paper, Romuald here and Robin Pichansky used the DSCFT correspondence to show that at the symbiotically late proper times, in a strongly coupled medium, in a Hebbian collision, the strongly coupled medium goes off to Bjorken hydrodynamics. So they essentially show that if the coupling is strong, Bjorken hydrodynamics is unavoidable in a collision of two very large nuclei. In this work, we will, and what I'll talk about today is, first of all, rederiving this result using a different approach, which I believe is actually slightly simpler. So rederiving Bjorken hydrodynamics at late proper times. And then the other thing is following some recent developments. Joe Kapusta, he got to leave to catch a flight. He pioneered this in the perturbative side last year or 2 years ago. Just looking at very, instead of very late times, looking at very early times and the early time dynamics. But this time we did it, of course, in the context of ADS CFT correspondence, assuming that early time dynamics in actual Hebbian collisions is strongly coupled, which is indeed just a model assumption. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's fun to look at this anyway. And we showed that at these early times, the energy density goes to a constant, which is nice. And what that means, actually, is that the longitudinal pressure, and I'll explain what I mean by longitudinal pressure in a second, initially is actually negative. So longitudinal pressure is negative initially, and then the system goes off to this Bjorken hydro, where, of course, all the three pressure components of energy momentum tensor are equal. So therefore, the system, as it goes from early times to late times, undergoes this isotropization transition, which is a necessary, though not sufficient, condition for thermalization. So therefore, we show that the isotropization condition, which was vigorously sought after in perturbative dynamics, and the issue is still not resolved, comes out very naturally in a strong coupling dynamics case. And finally, matching this early time and late time dynamics, we estimated this isotropization transition time, and we obtained for square root s 200 GeV per nucleon, we obtained the thermalization time, or isotropization time to be precise, of 0.3 Fermi over C, in good agreement with what's required for hydrodynamic simulations to break. Anyway, so just to keep it simple, this is a picture of the collision. Usually people in four dimensions call this time, and this is a Z axis, the collision axis, and so I'm going to use ADS space where there's already a Z variable. This is the X3, the collision axis. One has two nuclei colliding, and I'm using two variables. One is proper time, x naught squared minus x3 squared square root of, and this is, say, a line of proper time. It's sort of pretty much like time. And there is a rapidity variable, which is the angle with respect to the beam axis, if you wish. It's defined as a log of sum of x0 and x3 in the difference. All right, so if let's think about the collision of two very large nuclei, so pretty much infinite nuclei in the transverse direction, Lorentz contracted two pancakes, they go straight through each other and they start receding away. So this is the geometry first considered by Bjorken in the 80s. And in this geometry, if one assumes that the matter produced in this collision is boost invariant, which was a decent assumption at the time, and still a good starting point for any investigation. So assuming that everything is rapidity independent, you just have a plateau of particles any rapidity, one gets energy momentum tensor. One can write down the most general form of energy momentum tensor. So this is not assuming that one has whatever hydrodynamics or anything. One can define energy momentum tensor. And just from symmetry properties, one can see that, of course, there is energy density. And there are pressure components, but they don't, in principle, have to be equal. From the rotational symmetry, the cylindrical symmetry, rotation around the collision axis, one can see that the transverse pressures in x1 and x2 directions should be equal. And then there is a longitudinal pressure, p3, which does not have to be equal to these two other pressures. Now, so this is the collision, that's what I'm talking about, right? So x1 and x2 are the transverse direction. Conservation of energy momentum tensor gives us this simple equation for this tensor, for the energy density and the pressure p3. Now, we can study this equation in three extreme limits. So the first extreme limit is called free streaming. When the particles are produced in the collision, they don't interact and they just free stream away. That actually corresponds to the case when longitudinal pressure is zero. And then what you see is that equation, if you put P3 equals zero, the equation becomes only for energy density, dE d tau is negative E over tau. The solution of this equation, of course, is simple. The energy density scales as 1 over time. This is a scaling characteristic of free streaming. Indeed, it's natural because, say, the total energy stored in the system is energy density times the time tau, and it is conserved for this free streaming medium. So that's natural. Another limit, of course, is the celebrated Bjorken hydrodynamics, when we have three pressures which are equal. And The hydrodynamic equation then becomes of this type, d tau is negative E plus P over tau. And here one needs some more input to relate P and epsilon solve this hydrodynamic equation. And for the ideal gas, or say for traceless energy momentum tensor, one can, of course, write E equal to 3P, plug it in, and get this Bjorken's famous result of the energy density for an ideal hydrodynamic scales as 1 over tau to the 4/3. Of course, the total energy in this regime is not conserved, but the total entropy is conserved. All right, so what am I talking about when I talk about isotropization? So in general, any positive longitudinal pressure, you can see generates deviation from 1 over tau regime. So if longitudinal pressure is 0, energy density scales as 1 over tau. If it's non-zero, it falls off with time faster than 1 over tau. That's all there is to it, right? So what happens, of course, this pressure P3 does some work in the longitudinal direction and therefore contributes to the decrease of the total energy, or recurrently generates some power delta here. So non-zero positive longitudinal pressure and isotropization is equivalent to deviations from this 1 over tau regime. That's what isotropization means for me. In color glass approach, perturbative approach to Hagian collisions, it has been, so this is a third limit of interest, it has been shown by Lappi last year that energy density scales as log squared tau at very small times tau. So if energy density scales as a log, you see if you differentiate the log, log squared, right, you kill one of the logs. So essentially, it's as good as constant. At the leading log level, one can drop the derivative, and energy density becomes equal to negative P3, or equivalent P3 becomes equal to negative energy density. So the longitudinal pressure initially is negative, and the transverse pressure, say for traceless energy momentum tensor, can be shown to be equal to the energy density here. Okay, so that's another interesting regime. This is the energy momentum tensor, so the transverse pressure is equal to energy density. Longitudinal pressure is negative, and its absolute value is equal to the energy density. Okay, so those are the three known limits.
It is traceless.
I'm just Yeah, I'm sorry. This should be equal to the sum of the, upper, lower, whatever. You know how to fix it. Okay, so now, so what are we doing? Well, we're following the standard approach to this problem, again pioneered by Yannick and Pyzhanski. We have the ADS metric with three unknown functions here. One needs to solve Einstein equations in ADS space. One way of doing it is by expanding the metric in a perturbative series around the boundary. Now, the bottom line here is that if we live in Minkowski space, the second coefficient is zero, and the fourth coefficient gives us the expectation value of energy momentum tells. Okay, so that's all we need to do to pull out the energy momentum tensor. Well, it's not that little to do, right? One has to solve the Einstein equation, but that's how one pulls out the energy momentum tensor, expectation value for the energy momentum tensor for this problem. Okay, well, so we started off, let's start off by doing iterative solution. I assume that energy density is some function of tau, and one has to assume a specific form for this function, because that's a boundary condition for Einstein equations. And then one can solve Einstein equations perturbatively order by order in Z, for small z. And then the idea is once one finds the full solution, maybe by resuming this perturbative series or some other ways, as you'll see, the solution in ADS space should determine which functions are allowed here, therefore uniquely defining how energy density should scale with proper time. Okay? However, on the boundary, this procedure just gives two conditions, two sort of trivial conditions on the energy momentum tensor, conservation of the energy momentum, and the trace excess. So one needs to do more. One needs to go into the bulk and find some other conditions which would help us restrain the energy density as a function of tau, because these two conditions are not going to cut, right? This we've known for like millennia. All right, maybe not as long. Okay, so iterative solution is the first step. Again, following Romuald and Robby, we write all of these metric coefficients as exponents of lowercase a, b, and c. Everything is a function only of tau and z, proper time and the ADS variable. And then one expands this into the power series, each of these coefficients. They start with order z to the fourth, because remember, when the metric is Minkowski, z squared coefficient is zero. So let's start doing this, implementing this procedure, assuming the power law scaling of energy density. Again, we do this expansion, this perturbative expansion in the powers of z. And we did it, Mathematica produces some horrible expressions. Let me just show you the structure of them by pulling out one of these coefficients. This is the coefficient a2. a2 comes with z to the eighth into a, which feeds into the metric as e to the a, right? So a capital was the exponent of this. So here's an example. So delta, again, is the power of tau. So energy density scales as the power of tau, and this power is delta. So you can see this is one of the terms. It is a sum of two terms with different time dependence. So one can see that if we're looking at late times, at large tau, this term would dominate. And if we're looking at early times, low tau, this term will dominate. Right? Right?
The assumption about the delta.
Very good. I was expecting this reaction, right? How much can I sell people after lunch? Probably a lot. Right. So, of course, delta for that has to be greater than negative 4. Now, this gives me an opportunity to make a brief discourse. So, again, in this wonderful paper by Yannick and Pyzhanski, it was shown that if we want the energy density to be non-negative, we want to be physical, in all frames, one generates the following conditions, only allows physical powers or allowed behavior with tau. First of all, the derivative of energy density should be negative. It should decrease with time, which is natural, right? The nuclei are moving apart, energy density decreases. And then there is this condition here, which is slightly more involved. Anyway, if we plug in this power law, what do these conditions imply for the power delta? Well, Of course, this condition is trivial, delta is less or equal than 0. That condition gives delta greater or equal than negative 4. So we're reasonably safe in the assumption that one term dominates at early times and one term dominates at late.
How can acquiring positive energy density give you an arrow of time?
Gives me an arrow?
Yeah, I mean, I can just run the Yannick-Prashansky solution backwards, right, and have epsilon prime negative?
No. This is for positive. I don't understand. You're saying that your energy density would actually increase with time?
Yeah, just watch the thing go backwards.
So you want to take tau going to negative tau?
Well, he wonders why, if you take the first inequality, how the second one can possibly follow.
This doesn't lead to that, also. To,
no, the second one follows from the
Well, so what Yannick and Pijan, I mean, Romuald should probably comment on that. You just take T mu and you define energy density in a particular frame by the zero, by the appropriate component of T mu in the boosted frame. And then they pick various boosts and they get various combinations for the energy density after the boost and they get this condition. And it's really just a technical thing. We can talk more about it later. This is, we'll agree that at late times, you know, minus 4/3 is the smallest we see in 4 dimensions, and minus 1 is the largest we can see. And this includes that interval. All right, so late time solution. Well, this is just, again, reiterating on what Romuald did with Robbie, one expands. So picking up these terms which dominate at late times, one can see that the series. It becomes a series in a particular parameter, right? We have z to the 4th delta, z to the 8th, tau to the 2 delta, etc. So this parameter, Romuald and Robbie called it v, z times tau to the delta over 4 times a notice some coefficient which comes from this, it's a coefficient in front of the lowest order term actually right here, and a naught is negative. This the a naught is my notation, the parameter is theirs. Then you can see that at late times, what this implies that all these coefficients becomes a function of the single parameter v, and one can solve Einstein equation in this scaling regime. And again, we comment on a naught, energy density is related to a naught by this formula. A naught is negative, energy density is positive. Sorry for this backwards notation. Okay, so Yannick and Pijanski's late time solution is shown here. You solve Einstein equations, you get this whole bunch of logarithms as a solution. And so delta is again the power of proper time, and there is this quantity d, which is just the square root of a polynomial in delta, just for brevity. Okay, but the question is what fixes delta, right? I mean, does really anything go? And what Yannick and Pijanski did, they said, well, you know, let's impose an extra condition on the solution, and let's require that the curvature invariant has no singularities, that it is finite. And this allowed them to fix delta to be negative 4/3 and to obtain Bjork and hydrodynamics as the only allowed solution. Well, this is a fine procedure. What we're suggesting is something slightly simpler, namely, let's look at this solution. Of course, they're very complicated, but you can see that there are, of course, v is a real number. You have 1 minus dv to the 4th in the log of that quantity. It has a branch cut for this 1 minus dv to the 4th less or equal than 0. Now you say, well, so what a branch cut, right? Well, a branch cut really is not your run of the mill singularity of the metric. Branch cut really means that the metric doesn't really exist in this region because the metric vector be real and single valued. Whereas, you know, if we have a log branch cut, the metric immediately becomes complex and multivalued. So one has to do, so does it mean that the solution doesn't exist in that region? So does it mean that the solution only works in a certain region of a DF space but not in some other region? Well, it's actually not true. We can do away with this branch cut and get away with a single valued real metric because remember, all these coefficients enter the metric in the exponent. So we have the metric coefficients are actually e to the power of a, to the powers of a, b, and c. So therefore, these logs, this branch cuts, and this ambiguity can be eliminated if the coefficients in the front are integers, right? E to the integer times I pi would give us, you know, plus or minus sign, but not gonna give us a complex valued metric. Okay, so that's what I was talking about. All of them enter the metric in the exponent. So all we need to do is require for this coefficients to be integers for the for capital A, B, and C to be single valued and real. So all one has to do is take all the three coefficients in front of the three logs and equate them to three integers, N, M, and L. Call it whatever your favorite label for integers are. After that, it's an algebra problem. You can give it to your preschooler, and they're going to work it out. Obtaining that the only allowed power, remember, d is some function of delta, is a square root of a polynomial in delta, so it requires some algebra knowledge of quadratic equations. And in the end, the only allowed power which satisfies this condition is delta of negative 4/3, giving us Bjork and Fedder dynamics. So one doesn't really need to. I mean, it's a powerful tool in posing the finiteness of this curvature invariant, but it's really not necessary at this point to reproduce Bjork and Fedder dynamics at late times.
Is this condition sufficient to ensure that the other one is satisfied?
Yes. Well, the other one, by if delta is negative 4/3, the other one is satisfied. You can plug it in and see.
It's the only solution.
It's the, well, delta of negative 4, amazingly, is also a solution, but remember, we're looking in the region when delta is greater than negative 4.
Is it greater or equal?
Yeah, well, strictly speaking, it's greater or equal. yeah, there is something, so honestly, there's something special about delta of negative 4. It keeps popping up, and I think it's some residual knowledge maybe of Landau Hydra. You know, in Landau Hydra, I think energy density goes as 1 over 10 to the 4th. But you're making me go back. What?
No, I don't want to.
All right, well, you asked the question. You have to suffer. Too late, right. You see, when we pick this solution over that one, we assume the delta is greater. If delta is 4, then we cannot even, the scaling doesn't work anymore.
There is a log.
A log.
A log.
What log?
No,
they become comparable, and I cannot just keep these coefficients. I'll have to include those ones, and the solution changes completely. So as far as Janik and Pijanski solution is believed to be dominant at late times, it's only true for delta greater than negative 4. For delta equal to negative 4, you have to keep the other piece and reanalyze the problem. Frankly, I don't see much point because it's hard to believe that energy density falls off so fast. I mean, even in ideal Bjorken case, it falls off as 1 over tau to the 4th. You don't look happy, but we can talk later. All right, now back to where I was.
No other.
No other. No other. Other than that, nothing. Keeping me honest, aren't you? Okay, early time solution. So just doing the same trick for early times. One gets the series of this type, which is in the power of new quantity, which is z over tau, z squared over tau squared. However, the prefactor is not really a function of that quantity. So one doesn't get the scaling in terms of a single scaling variable anymore. But nevertheless, one can define u as z over tau, and conjecture and ansatz. So the series becomes a series in U times some power of tau in the front. And one can conjecture, therefore, the metric coefficients to be exponents of this tau times alpha and take the limit of fixed U and early times tau. So the power becomes small and we expand this. The reason we really have to expand this exponent is because there are higher order corrections in tau in this language which are not included by this ansatz. So we don't have any control over them. So we really only have control over this linear piece. Come, all right, we'll go. Okay, and the same for B and C. So there are some unknown functions, alpha, beta, and gamma, functions of U, which need to be found. So all we have to do, plug these three things in the Einstein equations and expand them in tau to this order of tau to the delta plus 4, or whatever corresponding order in the Einstein tensor one gets. And, you know, after a little bit of work, one ends up with hypergeometric functions. So A here is... say this first coefficient, right? This is a tau to the 4 plus delta power, and then the unknown function I was looking for is u to the 4 times this hypergeometric function, which is a series in u, as advertised, and it depends on the power delta. And for others, I get some combination of hypergeometric functions. Now, well, you say, oh wow. What can you do with these horrible hypergeometric functions, right? What are they good for? Well, the thing is, you open your favorite book on special functions and you see that hypergeometric functions also have a branch cut. They have a branch cut for u greater or equal than 1. We end up with branch cuts again. For u greater than 1, they become complex valued again, and not single valued also. Depends how you approach the real axis from above or from below. And so we have a branch cut again. Again, we want to get rid of branch cuts. And how do you get rid of a branch cut? Well, you say we have a geometric series, a hypergeometric series. We can get rid of the branch cut if the series terminates at a finite order and becomes a polynomial. Okay, another discourse about allowed values of proper time. Now, at early times, and again, using physical intuition, the total energy is the energy density times time, tau at early times. And if I want the total energy to be finite, then we conclude, so with the energy density scaling as tau to the power delta, that the allowed values of delta are greater or equal than negative 1. So in this range, the physically allowed powers, remember, delta had to be less or equal than 0. And now for the total energy to be finite, it has to be greater or equal than negative 1. So therefore, one could, in this interval, one could look at the hypergeometric functions and see where the series would terminate. And you can see that actually only delta equal to 0 works here. Okay, and delta equals 0 really means that energy density goes to a constant at early time tau, plugging it in, you can just again read it off from the other components of the metric tensor, or just plugging it, this energy equal constant to into hydrodynamic equations. We see that initial pressure in the strongly coupled system is negative, equal to negative energy density, and the transverse pressure should be equal to the energy density because of tracelessness of energy momentum tensor, which again looks the same way as the colored glass condensate energy momentum tensor. So the perturbative energy momentum tensor at early time also looks like this, though the perturbative energy density has a log square tau divergence at early times tau.
Can you find log type of solutions here?
Right, that's the next point. So if delta is sort of a ballpark, right, more or less constant, what is a constant? Maybe constant is a well-disguised log. So to look for a log, actually, one has to look for leading and sub-leading log. You see, if you're looking at the leading log and looking at Einstein equations, at the log level, the log will just factor out with an overall log, the leading log. So you have to pull in the sub-leading log terms to try to fix the power delta. See, if log factors out, it cancels, it gives no constraint on delta. So one has to actually work a little harder and follow the subleading terms. And actually, it turns out, without any branch cuts, that Einstein equations only, with the sign cuts, only have a solution for delta equals 0. It just, you take three equations, you find a solution, you plug the solution in the other two are satisfied only if, of course, if A0 is not 0, but you've got to start somewhere for delta equals 0. So therefore, if anything, the approach could be logarithmic. We don't know if A1 is non-zero or not. But yeah, so it's, even with a log accuracy, we simply be getting a constant. So this log squared divergence one sees in the perturbation theory appears to be absent here. Okay, so what am I telling you? Just the big picture. This is the energy density as a function of time. Yannick and Pyzhansky showed the late time solution, tau to the negative 4/3, right? What we seem to be arguing here is that energy density goes to a constant, starts off as a constant initially, and then there is some transition isotropization region in between, which I indicate by dashed line. This is by no means a plot. This is just my chicken scratch drawing with XFIG. Now, the idea is, what? Let's try to estimate the time of transition from one regime to another, this isotropization time. So isotropization transition could be estimated just by staring again at this, say, one coefficient. We have, so in general, this metric coefficient is a sum of early time-like solution and the late time-like solution, right? Now, the late time solution has a branch cut for in this V space when 1 minus dV to the fourth is less or equal than 0. The early time solution has a branch cut at U equals to 1. So if we use this power law ansatz at early times and we look for branch cuts, the first branch cut we hit is this one, whereas at late times, this is the first branch cut we hit. Remember, requiring that the branch cut disappears fixes the power of delta. So if we fix this branch cut, if we hit this branch cut first, we get delta equals 0. If we hit this branch cut first, we'll get delta of negative 4/3. So which branch cut we see first coming from the non-branch cut side of the ADS space is the one which gives us the power and determines what regime we're in. So this is a tau z plane, and I'm plotting essentially the branch cuts. This is the branch cut of Yannick and Pyzhansky. This is our branch cut. So you can see that our branch cut sort of dominates at early times. Theirs dominates at late times. That's why the power at early times is 0. The power at late times is negative 4/3. And the transition is right here. And we can, since we have the simple expressions for each of these branch cut lines, we can estimate this isotropization transition, and we get 3 over negative a naught to the 3a's. Remember again, a naught is a negative number. Now, this doesn't tell you anything, so let's try to explain this in some physical way. So, in a physical terms, if in the Bjorken hydrodynamics case, the energy density scales as some parameter epsilon naught over tau to the 4/3, that estimate of the isotropization time is just that. It's 3 over epsilon naught and c squared over 2 pi squared, all to the power of 3a's. So that's our estimate for isotropization time. One can plug in some numbers from Reed. So after consulting Uli, we decided to, you know, he advised me on which are the best numbers for. No. Everything is as written. Energy density has dimensions of energy per unit volume. And time would have.
Epsilon zero
is a really dimensionful quantity of what? There's time here, right? So, energy. E epsilon naught has dimensions of energy density times tau to the 4/3. So, it's Fermi to the negative 8/3.
In the box.
Epsilon naught. As dimension Fermi to minus 8 over 3.
Yes. And? Yeah, it's just a weird quantity, but it's the only way I can write it. So anyway. Okay, I demand this time to be added to my talk. All right, so to estimate epsilon naught, we take some average energy density at a particular time used by hydrodynamic simulations. And we derive epsilon naught to be 38 Fermi to the minus 8/3. Plugging in there, we get the isotropization time of 0.29 Fermi over C in agreement with hydrodynamics. Now, a little. Well, depends who you talk to. Derek, what do you think?
I recommend.
Sounds what?
Short. Well, this estimate is nothing but the standard estimate for relation of initial temperature and thermalization time. I mean, just dimensionally, that pi times
Is
this is,
it's actually even simpler, I think, in this case. I mean, you're probably right, but even without invoking temperature, one. So this is a self-critique slide. You know, you could say, all right, if you have a conformally invariant theory which has this Bjerkenheider behavior, you have a dimensionful parameter epsilon naught, right? So that gives you the dimensions of the only dimensionful scale because the theory is conformally invariant. So therefore, whatever time you have, the isotropization time for the onset of this behavior, it could be obtained by making an appropriate dimension, appropriate power of epsilon with the dimensions of time, which after you know a little algebra, one can see that it's epsilon naught to the minus 3 is, of course. So this would be some skeptic argument that you know what here comes from EGS CFT. And, well, of course, the counter argument would be, well, gee, well, we've got the prefactor, right? That comes from EGS CFT. Of course, if you plug in the numbers, the prefactor when C equals 3 is awfully close to 1. So I'll leave it at that. You judge whether it's a new result or not. Okay, so conclusions. Essentially, I hope I convinced you, we have, well, first of all, rederived the Yannick and Krzyzanski late time results without requiring the finiteness of the curvature invariant. And all we wanted for the metric to exist in the sense of being a real and single valued function, we analyzed the early time dynamics and showed that the energy density appears to go to a constant at early times, which means negative longitudinal pressure initially. That means that the strongly coupled system undergoes the isotropization transition, and that's the point. And we estimated this isotropization time and used it for KVM collisions, and we obtained something more or less consistent with hydro simulation, give or take. And I think hydro simulations have a precision to say if it's too short or too late, seriously. Thank you.
Your metric
at
early time, is it
ADS
plus small
ADS plus small correction. Didn't I have it at some point? Probably.
It's Minkowski plus small correction.
No, it's ADS. ADS plus small correction. Oh, essentially put this hypergeometric function to 1, the square brackets to 1 here, and everything to the right of here also throw it away.
There is one over z squared in front of the metric, or
there is? There is, yes. The way the metric is defined, again, revising the talk. Okay. No? Ah. So it's not Minkowski, it's ADS plus a small correction.
What happens in the infrared?
In the infrared as in large Z?
Yes.
You see, we don't know, because the limit we take in, we fix U, which is Z over tau, and we take tau to 0. So this is the metric really at small Z and small tau. It's analogous to what Yannick and Krzyzanski do on the other way, right? They fix V and take tau to infinity. So their solution actually is also, no, it's for large C, right? And right, and it's only in the infrared, but not in the union.
It's a local solution for large.
Local, if you, I don't know what you mean by local, but yes, yeah, only by the
close to critical point, and not sensitive to what is happening.
Right. In our case, and vice versa in our case. For that as well. Whatever you say.
You know, what strikes me is odd. I mean, we think of the whole problem as rejecting energy in some form, then letting the system evolve. But somehow working this way by, you know, just trying to find a consistent early time solution that evolves into this late time behavior, in some sense, you have no idea where it came from.
Right.
And it seems to be totally independent from where it came from. It was actually fixed by the late stage behavior.
What
it had to be
early on. This is the self-critique slide. Maybe I didn't put it on it. But part of the self-critique, of course, it's a bit backwards that this as a preposition time depends on the later time quantity. So it's really, I have no prediction for LHC. Right. So of course, what the ideal situation would be, of course, to improve on that and to tie it to some real initial state quantities. And yeah, I agree. Would be nice to do it. I just have no idea how to do it yet.
Conformal invariance was a huge assumption.
Conformal invariance, of course, is a huge assumption, which helps, yeah. But that's why it's a DSCFT, not a DSPCD.
Just to get the initial conditions. Now, what you do here, you relate the initial temperature and thermalization time.
What do you mean, initial temperature? No, no. What I meant by initial conditions is really at the level before thermalization,
exactly,
just the condition
exactly.
Itself.
So you relate these two, but to get the absolute value of either one, that is breaking conformal invariance. That's complete breaking to get the initial value of energy density.
No, no, no. Ideally, what I meant is one could. It's a bit oxymoron, but what one could express epsilon naught in terms of QS, saturation scale. It's oxymoron because the saturation scale means perturbative dynamics, and this is a strong coupling dynamics. But ideally, what I would like to do is express epsilon naught in terms of QS, and then I can predict QS more or less for LHC, and then I would be able to predict this quantity regardless of the temperature, and it still has conformal invariance, right? I just initiate by saying, okay, this is my scale QS, and everything else will be expressed in terms of QS. The
saturation scale is basically initial temperature.
No, it's a coefficient. When you write the initial, so initially you have a collision of two nuclei, you're just talking about energy momentum tensor, all these things, and this energy momentum tensor is a delta function on a light cone with a prefactor which depends on the energy, on the center of mass energy and QS. So you can formulate the problem this way. We talked to Romuald, actually, we don't really know how to really formulate it. And it's a long story, but ideally I would like to do it this way without any remark to temperature. Because, I mean, temperature is only something we can talk about at really late Bjorken times. And even then it wasn't clear.
After isotropization time, you talk about temperature.
Yeah, yeah. Well, presumably, yes.
Last question?
I love writing on Thomas's question. So, you start with some kind of boundary condition at late times, and then we try to see what was the initial time evolution which evolved to that late time, right? Well, sort of.
No, not really, not really. That's actually not true, right? No, I don't continue back. I just I started from late times just to show that my method works and I can reproduce the known result.
Okay.
What we really do, regardless, forget about late times. What we really say, let's assume energy density scales to the power of time. Let's find the right power for early times. And it's zero. The power is zero, so energy density is a constant. This was not really dependent on what happens at last, at late times.
So that's my answer.
Then yeah, maybe I misunderstood Thomas's question.
Because in the way that it was formulated, what I wanted to say, if you said yes, right? I wanted to say that
define yes.
That you cannot do. It seems to be a contradiction because if you have a dissipative evolution, then by definition it loses the information about the initial.
Absolutely, and it is of course dissipative because viscosity is not zero. Right. Now, it wasn't an extrapolation. Sorry if I gave up this.
No.
Just using the same method, starting with a known result, which happened to be a late proper time result, early, you know, early human time in 2005, that came first, right? So it was a result which was obtained first, but it's for late times, and now we're obtaining early time results at a later human time.
It seems to me that this is a more reasonable strategy for the daytime behavior, which we believe to be independent of where exactly you came from.
Well, at least for this particular theory, it seems like the theory itself dictates. But why do you think it's independent? You see, people are calculating viscous corrections, corrections to viscous corrections. Everything seems to be uniquely defined order by order. It's a hard calculation.
Maybe this is
let me finish. I mean, ideally, if all the coefficients are known, if some matcher guy comes and calculates all of them and there's some of them all, then the early time behavior would be uniquely defined.
Equilibrium actually depends on
what
the
conditions. So,
after that,
it doesn't depend. Yeah, so what I wanted to say is that
But once you're in Bjerknheim, you're in Bjerknheim. That's late time.
You have something to say that the late time, it seems to me that the late time behavior makes a lot more sense.
What makes?
You just look for this beautiful scalar area and flow, and that, of course, doesn't depend at all on how exactly you started.
Okay.
But you're actually trying to do it early, which, of course, should be.
Well, look, we're looking at a particular theory, right? And n equals 4 superior means. It got to have particular early time behavior, just like in PCD with
particular early time behavior. Behavior. Depending on what the initial state actually is.
Initial state not, being two nuclei collided.
If you're not injecting that anywhere.
Well, geometry. It defines my geometry.
Yeah, but it really defines this kind of state in the expansion.
Bjerknheim expansion.
You're saying that it's only one type of Fourier collision.
Okay, it's a particular type that I consider. I'm not saying that this is the way, but you know, EDS-CFT at least is verified unlike EDS-PCD.
But, I mean, you're effectively starting with infinitely thin pancakes. Okay. I mean, that's the geometry, but
that
really was the assumed initial.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, come on, guys. If we have to agree on something, we've got to agree on geometry.
No, I just thought it was worth emphasizing.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you, Larry.
I think we should move on. So let's thank you again.